Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
All right, so welcome to this new episode. My name is Victor Monin, and today I have the pleasure of welcoming Ernst-Jörg Reinberger, honorary professor of history of science at the Technical University of Berlin, and also director emeritus at the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science. And so first of all, thank you so much, professor, for having accepted my invitation to discuss your latest book, Split and Splice, Phenomenology of Experimentation, which has been just recently published at the University of Chicago Press. So to start delving into the matter at hand today, in your book, you concern yourself with scientific experimentation. And to quote you at the very beginning of the book, you characterize scientific experimentation as, quote, a knowledge-generating procedure. And in order to approach this procedure, you decide to do it from a very particular angle, I might say. The book is actually divided in two parts, respectively titled Infra-Experimentality and Supra-Experimentality. And it seems to be that you're trying to hold together both ends of a spectrum. I was wondering what kind of point of view you're trying to propose here to adopt on scientific experimentation, and how is approaching scientific experimentation from these two ends of the same spectrum differ maybe from previous ways in which historians or philosophers of science have approached this question so far?
Yeah, so you jump right into the middle of of things. You are completely right. So the division of the book is between infra and supra, tries to catch two flies with one stroke, so to speak. On the one hand, what I wanted to do is to get a vision that we could address as a perspective from below. So really going into the fine-grained details of the scientific process of experimentation. On the other hand, it is also very clear, and I'm aware of that, is that you can get lost in these details. Experimentation is a procedure that flows through all our modern sciences, basically, at least all of them, and has a long tradition behind itself already. So there is also broader and bigger features that do not come into view and into perspective if you deal with experimentation from a purely philosophical point of view, a kind of abstraction of the experimental process. And I wanted to make it concrete. On the one hand, concrete in terms of hands-on. On the other hand, concrete to kind of give the impression that we have to do with a historical process that is extending over time. And for this reason, the division of the book, I have chosen the division of the book as it is now.
It seems to me, if I can continue on this division between the infra and the supra, that in a way you were also trying to intentionally avoid the most blindly visible part of experimentation, because at least the way I interpreted your use of infra and supra here is kind of an analogy with the electromagnetic spectrum and the idea that if we're in the infra and the supra, we are not situating ourselves in the visible field in a way. What's directly visible to
us? This is a nice association. Actually, I did not think about it.
So it seemed to me that you were eluding what appears to be conveniently directly visible to us when we are considering experimentation. So I was wondering, was that intentional in a way? Were you trying to avoid certain pitfalls, maybe, in which philosophers and historians have previously fall when looking at experimentation?
Yeah. Yes, very consciously I have been choosing this and also the division because I think you're right with respect to the infra and the supra, both of these realms, if you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, in a way escape our senses. So usually if you write about the experiment from a purely philosophical standpoint or perspective, you deal with science and with results, with scientific results as they are presented in publications. So there is no direct experience of the experimental process behind it. And this, the experimental process as it takes place in the laboratory is, of course, something that is not available for everybody. People who are not trained in a particular science and do not have this kind of practical background, in a way, it's not easy to grasp what is going on there just by taking a published record that usually also does not confront you with the nitty-gritty of the experimental process, but just with a as clear-cut as possible presentation of the results, which is something different. And also with respect to the historical perspective, this is also something that in one way or the other is beyond our immediate and daily experience. So we have to consider a longer process that has been taking place in time, and we need to reconstruct this process. So it is not immediately before our eyes. So a historical perspective also has this kind of practical purpose to kind of make palpable that we have to do with something that is not just a yes-no play, a game of yes and no, but is embedded into a sometimes very long historical process.
So to talk about actually the nitty-gritty that you just mentioned of the process and the fact that the experimental process in many ways cannot be summarized by the sum of the publications and public presentation of results. The first part of the book, so on infra experimentality, is rich in illustration, and I thought that was also an interesting way in which the book is divided. Is that the first part is extremely rich in illustrations, whereas the second one shows none. So it's also illustrated the variety of approaches here. But to stick to the first part and and its richness of illustration. You show, for example, a picture of nucleic acid sequence gel. You show lines of DNA code, various models of protein syntheses and structures. You also show experiment sheets. And I thought that perfectly illustrated what you just mentioned about the nitty-gritty, what some call now the messiness of science. What do we learn from about scientific experimentation from bringing together all these materials together?
I think at one of the major points I tried to make in this first part is that the scientific process of doing experiments and making palpable what we have under our hands when we are doing experiments is very intricate mechanisms and procedures and options and possibilities of making things visible. And this is something that dominates the first part of the book throughout. It is a kind of making visible that is not immediately, that we cannot immediately compare with what we see with our naked eyes. So we see contours, we see colors, we see what have you, but what the kind of visibilization that we want to achieve in the sciences is to make palpable how parameters hang together, sometimes only two, sometimes more, and finding ways of putting them before our eyes, which is a process of invention in a way also. Think only of the kinds of visualization that that statistics has developed over the past 100 years. All these schemes and schemata that we are now that by now we are confronted with daily. Did not exist around 1800. They came into being as ways of making visible things that otherwise escape our senses. That's the reason. That's the reason for the richness of figures that dominate the first part, whereas the second part deals with a different kind of visualization.
When I there's actually, if I may continue to discuss this this really rich ensemble of visualization, as you mentioned, and ways in which experimental scientists are trying to figure out the contours of the things they're targeting and studying. There is to be a notion that you bring at the very beginning of that part on infra-experimentality that I would like you to comment on a bit, because I had a problem interpreting it really. You talk about this realm of figures and sheets, experimental sheets, the models, etc., as you define it as an underworld. And you also say that it happens under the hands of the experimenters. And I thought it very interesting because to me, it seemed as if you were suggesting that this world of images and models, etc., we're not only sometimes lost to the historians and the philosophers of science, but somehow we're paradoxically also lost to the scientists themselves. Maybe I was struggling in interpreting what you meant really by happening under the hands of experimenters. If there were some depth of meaning into that.
Yeah, we must not forget being confronted with this plethora of visualizations that we can find also in, of course, also in the scientific literature, and that are basically taken from that, besides the experimental sheets that are a bit nearer to the laboratory. What is usually forgotten is that these procedures and options and possibilities of making visible are connected to a research infrastructure, research technologies, and would not be possible without that. Yeah? For instance, the electron microscope creates a different kind of visualization than the option that is given with the use of radioactive tracers, for instance. Yeah? Worlds are between them. So they are inextricably connected to the research technologies. And there is a rich underworld of research technologies that is expanding and expanding in our days. So it is tremendous. It is also tremendously energy consuming. We have to keep in our mind. But this is usually abstracted from when it comes to a scientific publication. And also, scientists, of course, on the one hand, are used to manipulate these research technologies and to master them. But when it comes to present scientific results, they do not want to present their research technologies. They wanted to present their findings, always assuming, unconsciously assuming, that this background of research technologies is not interesting to the public. Although the results would not have been possible without that. And this is a kind of conundrum that also scientists have to struggle with when they try to make their work palpable to a broader public, for instance, but also to their colleagues.
Yeah, I understand completely that conundrum, and it seems like it also tragically, in a way, tied to the success of the experimental procedure in itself, because as efficient as these apparatus get, they also get as invisible because they function.
And also, of course, many of these research technologies over time become black boxed and in a way are themselves already made invisible, yeah? At least in their intimate functioning.
I appreciate you mentioning the black box, because one of the authors that came to my mind when I was reading, especially the later part of infra-experimentality portion of your book, actually has another concept also that I think is very similar to one of yours in the book. So at the end of the first part, you talk about experimental protocols and experimental sheets and notations that happen throughout the experimental process. And you describe the laboratory as a writing system and, quote, an indispensable space of notation for emergent knowledge, end quote. And such a phrase really evoked Latour and Wigler's description of the laboratory as a system of literary inscription. And that's what they write in their book, Laboratory Life, in 1979. What similarities does your approach to the laboratory as a writing system has with Latour and Wigler's, and how does it differ?
Yeah, so you are right. The book of Bruno Latour and Steve Woolgar has been a great inspiration to me. And sadly enough, Latour passed away last fall. I knew him rather well. I've had many discussions with him. I think there is, but actually it's also, I think what I tried to do in my book, that contrasts a little bit to the way Latour and Bulgar are describing the research technology as an inscription machinery. I try to make to differentiate between experimental traces and experimental data also in the first part of the book, because I think what we basically have to do with when we are doing an experiment is to bring a piece of nature, maybe already in a manipulated state, into contact with a research technology, creating an interface between these two entities so that it sparks, that it begins to emit traces that we can try to interpret. And these traces are usually of a rather volatile shape. They come into being and immediately disappear again. So we also have to invent ways of making them durable, which is, in a way, the process of inscription. Whereas the process of the creation of traces is something that belongs to the experimental setup itself. But without this experimental setup and without the interface between scientific object and research procedure, we would have no material to derive inscriptions from. And so this, for me, this differentiation between these two realms has been rather important, because I think it helps to really to understand what scientific experimentation is all about. But you are right; it's a great book, the Laboratory Life, that itself also still relies on a great French philosopher of science of the first half of the 20th century, and that is Gaston Bachelard. He actually was also using a little bit this kind of terminology already in the 1930s. So with respect to history and philosophy of science, we also have to be aware of that we are standing in a tradition, and that that history and philosophy of science have a history behind themselves that we should not forget, and that is constantly developing.
Yeah, I think if I may jump on that opportunity, I think in part of your book, and I think at this point we're in the second half of the book, you try to trace or at least to situate your endeavor within a larger, I would say, tradition of trying to think and divide the history of science. And you first mention Gaston Bachelard and his idea of, instead of thinking about scientific discipline, thinking more about scientific neighborhoods or quarters. And then you mentioned Bourdieu's concept of fields. And then you try to situate your own approach to it. How do you situate here your approach to, I would say, finding a unit, a historiographical unit for the history of science? Because I think this is what you're trying to get at in the second part of your book.
Yeah, I think in the second part of the book, what I'm trying to do is to show that the that on the one hand, we have to kind of the close look at the experimental process itself gives us an idea about the objects that are at stake in science. On the other hand, what we are trying to do is to report about them, to give a narrative of scientific knowledge and its development, and a narrative in one way or the other needs an object that creates something like a red thread through the story. And if it comes to historiography, so to history of science, and that was the kind of thing I wanted to convey in one of these chapters. I think the title is Narration and Science. Help me, I lost.
Let me just find it. Yes, I think it's Knowing and Narrating.
Yeah, Knowing and Narrating, yeah. What I wanted to convey there is that according to the time scale we are choosing, we also need to choose different entities along which we tell our story as historians of science. And if we are doing case studies, as a lot of historians of science do, an appropriate entity that could help structure your story is the notion of experimental system that has a limited lifespan of, let's say, 20, 25, maybe even 30 years, or cover the productive period of a scientist or of a group of scientists. But if we try to broaden our view and to envisage, for instance, the development of a science like molecular biology over 70 or 80 years now, from the 1930s to the 2030s, we have myriads of experimental systems in there, and it would make no sense to kind of take all of them into the story. So we need a different entity that plausibilizes our historical take. And the kind of suggestion I'm making in this chapter is that for these time spans that extend over maybe two or even three or four generations of scientists, something like experimental cultures could be the entity along which to tell a broader story. For instance, in the life sciences, the change from in vivo experimentation to in vitro experimentation at the end of the 19th century. And experimentation in vitro extended in its various developments and differentiations a whole century of work, with the result that today, with a refinement of research procedures and the options to make molecules themselves, macromolecules themselves, transform them into molecular tools, we have created a situation where we can return into the cell in vivo, yeah, and make visible what is going on there without having to destroy the cell, which was no option at the beginning of the 20th century. Here again, history is behind it. Research technologies are behind it. An experimental culture like the in vitro culture of biological experimentation appeared to me to be a good option to tell this process without losing contact with the experimental practice and just telling a story of ideas.
If we can remain on this question of how to tell the story of these experimental sciences and what kind of units, you mentioned the possibility of thinking in terms of experimental cultures, at least when we're dealing with longer time span. You write later in your book, and I quote you here, "A narrative is a proper narrative only as long as one can imagine that it could have emerged otherwise," end quote. And could you just explain how does this apply to the history of experimental sciences? And when I read this quote, I also gathered that maybe narratives, traditional narratives about experimental science have traditionally fell short to be a quote-unquote proper in some way or another?
Yeah, because usually what we are doing, or what is frequently being done, is telling the story from the point that has been reached back, so that you already know what happened and you can kind of frame your story that it culminates in the most recent accomplishments. And I think that's a storytelling with a teleological endpoint. Yeah, the telos, the aim behind the whole thing is already there, and we tell the story as a inevitable process that is approaching this endpoint. Whereas if you are immersed in a process of gaining knowledge about particular objects that we do not yet have, we do not have this endpoint yet. So the experimental process in itself, if you would like to address the experimental process itself as a story or as a narrative, it is a narrative that cannot tell you in advance where it will arrive.
So if I'm understanding correctly...
It is very difficult to convey this this idea in writing, finally, yeah? So because, of course, a historian, on the other hand, also inevitably is aware of the point from which he has to tell the story of the past. So this, it's a very tricky kind of thing to find a good way to deal with.
Yeah, I feel like what's at stake is writing a history that is not impoverishing in a way what the experimental procedure, the richness of the experimental procedure in the first place, in terms of, as you mentioned, different ways of visualizing, contouring objects or things that are interest. And I think you make an attempt, obviously, in this book at presenting a way of writing such a history. And you make also an attempt at, in various moments in the book, of coining terms, I think, to capture this idea. And I'll quote you here like a couple more times, where you talk about the tamed fantasy of research. I found this quote absolutely fantastic. But you also talk about the wild in scientific thinking. So there's a lot more other oxymorons as well throughout the book. And I was wondering here, maybe what if you could explain what you're trying to capture in an expression such as the tamed fantasy of research.
Yeah, what I try to do there and to somehow to render palpable is that the scientific research process is basically about things that we do not yet know about enough. Yeah. So otherwise, we would not be after. Yes, we simply would not take upon us all these experimental efforts. We want to know things from which we do not yet know what they are. Exactly. So we can have hunches and all the kinds of things, but actually the research process is about this ignorance. It's not about knowledge, it's about ignorance, yeah? And about overcoming ignorance, but in directions that we cannot completely foresee. So there is an element of wildness here. If this element is being lost, we ourselves are lost to our procedures, and are more or less doing uninteresting things. Yeah. So the research process is something that has in its innermost, there is a kind of creative force that also... For me, at least, this is the thing that keeps scientists in their business for a whole life. Otherwise, they would not spend 30 or 40 years in dusty or bad-smelling or whatever laboratories. Actually, as they were of yesterday, maybe in future AI, everything will be clean.
You end your book on a very interesting note, you call it a eulogy to fragments. And I thought it very interesting, I think, because your book obviously has this trajectory from taking a deeper look into this underworld, as you mentioned, of experimentation, and then trying to explain how this look can inform the writing of the history of science and the history of experimental cultures. But when it comes to fragments, what's interesting is that I think you're trying to bring both ends together at this point of the book. Experimental scientists and historians of science both deal with fragments, you explain. But although in different ways, historians and scientists somehow seem to mirror each other in a way. They both split and slice. And I believe that this is what you hinted at, I think, in the introduction of your book, where you hoped that the term split and splice would not only become, and I quote you, clear, but you also hoped that they would become plastic. And at first I was confused by what you meant here by plastic, but I think in this sense, you meant for your book to end in a whirl where the historian of science doesn't seem to be scrutinizing the scientist from above or even from within as a sort of ethnologist, but instead the historian at the end is invited to be looking at a mirror, and I mean by that an inverted image of himself or herself. How do you understand here the relationship between historians of science and scientists? What do they have to learn from each other? Because I feel like there's an interesting ending here of how to combine the two.
Yeah, I think in the end, what is behind it, and it is very consciously chosen as an end of the book and not as the beginning of a book. You could imagine also that it would make some sense if you put it at the very beginning. So first you take the details and then afterwards the great picture. And so this I try to invert in the book by putting the chapter on fragmentation at the very end. Yeah. So it is a kind of rehearsal also. And it basically tries to make the argument that we could look at doing history of science, so practicing the history of science, as an experimental process in itself. So this is what you mean by mimicking. So it whether mimicking is the right word here.
I'm not sure, mirroring in a way.
Mirroring, yeah, mirroring. Mirrors have also many connotations to them. But in the end, basically, that's the argument I try to make, that we also, history of science has also to be seen as an experimental process in the end that is developing over time, that is sometimes slowly changing, sometimes at a quicker pace. And each and every historian of science in one way or the other is, whether he or she is aware of it or not, is contributing its own fragment to the whole story. So there is fragmentation, and the notion of fragment is here at different levels and in different layers, which also in a way tries to capture the complexity of the whole book. So,
yeah, I think to me this very last chapter of the book on fragments made me see anew the first part with all these pictures, which I almost automatically looked at them as sources. And suddenly I began to see them as fragments instead of possibly a larger picture that is either inaccessible or indirectly accessible somehow. And so in that sense, I think you conveyed that point of the historians also dealing with fragments, just like, or dealing, strangely enough, dealing with the fragments that the scientists are themselves producing. So it's a sort of dealing, interesting.
We could put it that way, dealing with a fragment, talking about fragmentation and being itself a fragment. So you have three levels there.
I would like to end on a more a broader question that pertains to just the book itself. In the introduction of your book, you write that the questions raised here have occupied you persistently over the past two decades. So it's obviously a very important book in many ways, I'm assuming, for you as well. But interestingly enough, this book is an English version of a prior German edition that was published in 2021. And so as your book itself revolves around the question of repetition and difference, and how the process of repetition and differentiation creates instances of new knowledge, I was wondering, because there's no better process of repetition and differentiation than translation and rewriting. So you yourself went through that process for this book, Split and Splice. And so I was wondering what new things, what new instances of knowledge maybe emerged for you through that process of repetition and differentiation.
Yeah, this is a very interesting and also an intriguing question, but I have made the experience already in the book that came out, the book on Toward the History of Epistemic Things, more than 20 years back, where the situation with respect to languages was just the other way around. The first version was an English version, and it took some time until I had then a version in German, in the German language, ready. But this time it is the other way around. But for me, a translation has always been something, an enrichment of your own experience with writing. And therefore, I did not have it translated by a translator. I did the translation myself, with the result that also the book has become slightly different. So it is not a one-to-one translation. It is a rendering of the same or the similar, basically, of course, the same ideas, but in two different languages. And it forces you to kind of express yourself in a slightly different way according to the language at hand. So, and that is the difficulty for, always the difficulty for somebody who acts as a translator and is forced to kind of narrowly follow the original, which I have not been forced to do. So I could deal with my own German script. I could handle it in a different way. And it also you also learn from doing translations. It is the, I would say, the most intense way of reading is translation. And in reading your own stuff, you often come across flawed passages where you kind of have the impression, okay, here I'm hiding something that I didn't know better, and so, but it is not yet there where it should be. And so these kinds of things, of course, then come to the fore when you do a translation.
I assume it gave you the opportunity to delve once more into the fantasy of your own research, if I may say. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Professor, for your time, for having taken the time to answer my questions and give some perspective on your new book, Split and Splice. Thank you so much.
Hey, it was my pleasure.